Last week, you might have headed to Wikipedia.com to look up, say, Marlon Brando or the currency in Guam. Whatever you were curious about that day, we're not going to ask. You probably didn't find what you were looking for, did you? You found a blackout protest asking you to imagine a world without free knowledge. Think of all the term papers that stalled and trivia contest cheaters who were derailed. An estimated 160 million people saw the blackout page that day. Then, in the news the very next day, a file-sharing website called Mega Upload was shut down by the U.S. Department of Justice, and the online hacktivist Anonymous retaliated, shutting down the sites of everyone from the Recording Industry Association to the FBI. This is all about the same thing. The question of this century. Who controls the Internet? I'm Jabalani LaFall. We'll explore that more on today's Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Online, the web, the internet, the interwebs. No matter how you describe the information superhighway or our global network moving at the speed of thought, one thing is for certain. We've reached a point where government policy and the world of e-commerce are now intersecting in more ways than ever. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. From net neutrality to the other e-tax, electronic commerce tax, to the Google broadband usage debate, we're surfing a host of topics today with our regular radio help desk, a.k.a. the computer guys, George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien, CEO of Ideology. Also joining us for this discussion thread is Scott Cannon, a reporter for the Kansas City Star. Welcome, one and all.
Good morning.
Morning. Great to be here.
Scott, let's begin with you and the juiciest local internet-related topic, Google Fiber. You write that, and I quote, "The so-called Google Fiber project in Kansas City isn't only something the company has never tried before. It's something that probably strays furthest from anything the company has ever succeeded or failed at. What's more, there's a reason you don't have to whip fast downloads now. The industry that serves you up internet now has deemed it unprofitable and unnecessary." That's very poignant in talking about the Google Fiber situation.
Right. Super high-speed internet is also at the same time right in Google's wheelhouse because Google wants you online. The more you're online, the more their advertising gets to you. The more they learn about you, the more they can target that advertising, and the more their profits can continue to go up. They've proven themselves to be very good at this, and what they can demonstrate in Kansas City is if they can make it a profitable go of this sort of service, it puts pressure on Comcast and Time Warner and the rest to do similar things in other communities.
But that's not necessarily their bread and butter, the pipes. Their bread and butter is the search and the advertising and the eyeballs.
Right. This, if it's their bread and butter, it's a whole new dish for them. They've not done anything like this. They've not done anything where they have to send people out to your home, hooking up wires, fielding your calls when things aren't working right. So it's a brand new business for them. They acknowledge that. They say they've done a lot of study to get that sort of consumer customer service right. But the cable companies, for instance, are very skeptical whether they can pull it off.
Bread, butter, dish. I like what you did a moment ago with that. You seem to really, though, play up the uncertainty and even suggest that the search giant could fail in its attempts at high-speed networking. How did you draw those conclusions?
Well, Google will tell you that they don't think they'll fail, but they're willing to. There's been people who analyze the company say one of the things that makes them so successful mm-hmm. is they've been willing to go bust on
exactly.
things. They've had services in the past that haven't gone well. Buzz, which was sort of their first attempt to go at Facebook. Now it's Google Plus, which has a lot of numbers on it, but not a lot of activity yet. So they're a company that's daring. And that's part of the reason they've been so successful.
Let's bring in George and Thomas for this. You guys have been talking about this, thinking that perhaps for months, right now there's more of a look of success or more of a look of failure where the project is concerned. Google has been making a lot of acquisitions that a lot of people don't know about in the private sector and making a lot of efforts at different businesses, and they all haven't panned out.
True, true. Well, I mean, when you're a company as big as Google or Apple, for that matter, I mean, they're constantly buying small companies. You know, they buy companies and we don't even notice it.
They buy one at a rate of one a day in the last year.
Almost, yeah.
Certainly.
Well, they're buying talent, right? It's just a different way of hiring people in some ways.
Or patents or concepts.
intellectual property, that sort of thing. One thing about Google and Google Fiber I thought was interesting is about a year or a year and a half ago, you know, they had a competition of trenchers out in California at Google HQ, and it was to see, you know, which team could trench fiber down this 50-yard channel in a parking lot the fastest. And so naturally, when they announced the Google Fiber project here, I was thinking, oh, well, they're just going to trench right down the middle of the streets because they can actually run these new machines. They cut a little slit in the pavement.
And then they go.
They bury the cable 9 inches underneath, and they sweep up after it, and it's you can almost not tell it's there. But when we found out that they were going to go aerial on it, that's when I started to think, you know, there's a little bit more complexity to going aerial than there is than you might think.
And given the complexity, go back to one of your comments, Scott, in a recent article you wrote, if Google fails in Kansas City, it is Kansas City, not Google, who will have failed to realize the potential business value of the modern broadband infrastructure. Computer guys, is there truth to that statement? Is it on Kansas City? Is the onus on Kansas City to utilize Google Fiber and not on Google?
I think in a large sense that there is. You know, there's been a recent competition for business plans that leverage the Google Fiber gigabit. And I went to the finals of that. There were like 18 companies or ideas that pitched their plans. And in my view, only a couple of them really leveraged the bandwidth available. In other words, they were great business plans or neat ideas, but they didn't rely on this immense amount of bandwidth.
Scott Cannon, that's a strong statement. It's Kansas City, not Google, who will have failed to realize the potential business value.
Yeah, I don't actually remember writing that, but if you say I did, I did.
It's on there.
It's clearly the Google's interest is less in what sort of businesses might pop up, but what happens when everybody gets this to their house. They've made it very clear that they want to see what happens if you can upload and download things at a gigabyte per second, which is 100 times faster than the average broadband that people have today. Now, they're going to – you'd like to see some sort of businesses popping up, and there might be some. No one yet has identified the sort of killer app that comes with this. We can all stream video today already. We can teleconference today, and we'll be able to do that better. But it's not real clear what the sort of game-changing thing that will take place. I went to a campus of Stanford and the faculty housing there, and recently Google hooked them up with a service very similar to what's going to be here in Kansas City. People liked it. They loved it. But it wasn't changing their lives.
And that's the key. It's not changing lives.
It might, though, when you get
hundreds of thousands.
It's not a killer app
in and of itself.
Well, part of the problem is that Kansas City is just one city, you know, and in some cases, in order for this to really work right, you need not just Kansas City, but Seattle and Chicago and, you know, a bunch of other cities with the same capability so you can go back and forth as efficiently.
Now, George, there's two Kansas cities involved. One is in a place called Kansas. The other is in a place called Missouri, depending on who's keeping score.
Very funny.
Shifting the discussion a little bit, part of what Google has been an advocate of is called net neutrality. Posing this question to the panel, remind our listeners, what is net neutrality and why is it so important? And Scott Cannon, you can feel free to jump in on this too. Thomas, we'll go to you first.
Well, it's a concept that I guess in my view that where you don't want to give preference to any particular type of internet traffic. So, you know, the internet, the big lines that move the data are owned by various companies, Sprint, the other telecoms, and they have the ability to give preference or even to block you know, traffic of various kinds. Imagine what would happen like if Time Warner decided they wanted to block Netflix or slow it down because they're in competition with one another. That would be one reason why you'd want to rely on net neutrality rules from the FCC. So,
George, net neutrality, where are we?
Where are we? Good question. You know, we're in the midst of the ongoing discussion that's been going on for however many years it's been. But to me, so that the average person gets a better grip on this, really the best way to look at it is if you're in a car and you're going down Main Street, you know, and there's three lanes in the going north, let's say, and the city has designated one lane as a bus lane. you know, and they won't allow anybody in the bus lane during rush hour except buses. I mean, that's the same principle. You know, they're cutting down, they're restricting who can use that bandwidth of the street. And in the case of Comcast or Time Warner or some of the other providers, you know, they also want to structure their rates in such a way that if they give you priority, they can charge you more. So it's as much of a money-making venture as anything else.
And Scott Cannon, you argue that opening up the pipes, opening up the broadband infrastructure in the Google Fiber project is, in fact, a case for net neutrality.
Well, and so Google would sort of almost wants to muscle past that problem, right? So if we've got such a big fat pipe that traffic isn't clogging anywhere, then net neutrality becomes a little less of an issue.
True.
A little less of a debate.
Right.
You're tuned in to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Right now we're discussing the Internet and technology policy and where they collide, along with the particular potential drawbacks of Google Fiber, with George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, Thomas O'Brien, the CEO of Ideality. Also joining us in the discussion thread is Scott Cannon, reporter for the Kansas City Star. Stay tuned for the second half of today's show when we'll bust out a technology news lightning round. That's later on in the program. Kansas City, what is your biggest concern about the future of the Internet? We're talking high-tech policy today, and we want you to join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And please feel free to use technological tools such as Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at KCURCST. Right now we're talking about net neutrality. When this so-called net neutrality quotient, whatever that looks like, gentlemen, is achieved, what's the end game? Will it be about speed? Will it be about content choices? Or will it be about access? What's it really about, and who's the biggest winner?
I don't want to get too wonkish on this, but, you know, the FCC is the one, the agency that controls that, and it's a rule that they have established, which went into effect actually last November. So it hasn't been that recent. There was congressional action to actually block them from being able to implement it, but that has been put aside. So, you know, there's always some tug of war going on in D.C. about, you know, about this thing, and the larger companies that control some of these things are the ones that are pushing for more ability to control their own network. They see it as, you know, something that's limiting them in terms of their ability to do whatever they want with their company.
But didn't this all get started, as I said before, on the basis of money, because they wanted to charge more for the people that they put at the head of the line, so to speak? I mean, that's how the whole thing started.
Well, it all comes down to money. Is this about the premium traffic as well, Scott Cannon?
Right. It could potentially be, say, Time Warner, another source of income if someone pays that extra fee to sort of get into your bus lane, and the analogy played out earlier. It's also, there is some practical things. So if your neighbor is constantly uploading and downloading movies, some sort of file sharing, likely piracy, it might be in your interest and in the cable company's interest to be able to regulate that, say, hey, we're going to throttle him at a certain speed so he doesn't take up the entire pipeline.
Off the policy question for a minute, Bill from KC is curious, what kind of hardware upgrade is going to be needed to utilize Google Fiber? Do we even know?
Well, yeah. I mean, you're going to have a device in your home that can handle that kind of speed.
So, a router,
you know,
a server?
Yeah,
a
router.
Usually like
some kind of router-modem combination.
Cable modem.
It could be that they'll just drop it right into your PC, which, right. You know, most PCs these days have gigabit connections on their network cards. So, but generally, it's probably going to be a router.
You know, at Stanford, where they've done this, there's a little magic box they have that sort of translates it. The trick is what you have now will likely work with it. You probably won't have to buy anything more than what Google does. But whether it get the most out of it, whether it'll be able to work at these hyper speeds is the issue.
We're discussing Internet and tech policy and what Google Fiber may or may not have to do with that. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. What is your biggest concern about the future of the Internet from a policy standpoint? Let's cut and paste into another discussion, fellas. The Protect Intellectual Property Act, PIPA, or the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA. What are these beyond very annoying acronyms?
Tom's probably up on this more than I am. I mean,
protecting
content. Let's pass it over to Scott.
Well, I'm not hardly an expert, but you might think of it as Northern California versus Southern California. It's Silicon Valley versus Hollywood.
Exactly.
Right? So Hollywood wants something to do so you can't pirate their movies. In some way, the SOPA and PIPA that went down sort of ran into an online revolt, and Google was among the people that was helping there. Where it was setting up ways in which the government might go in and shut down your entire website if one page on your website was doing something that looked to be pirated. So, you know, the flip side of that is, you know, you want to have sort of free sharing on the internet, and can you go in there and do it in a clumsy way like this appeared to be, at least politically, or is there some other way to make it work?
But there's also a co-joining of interest as well, because you still have software manufacturers, Tom, who are also, such as Microsoft, who are also afraid of their proprietary software being pirated or downloaded via the internet as well. So there are some co-joining interests with Silicon Valley and Hollywood as well.
That's what makes it so complicated. I mean, they're thinking that a lot of the piracy is offshore, outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. The big problem with SOPA for the big Google-type companies was that they would be forced to become kind of the enforcers of this. The government can't touch the people outside the country, so they go touch Google and say, stop this.
And what's interesting about this, George, is that initially tech giants and internet and browser giants such as Mozilla and Google at one point supported the Protect Intellectual Property Act and the Stop Online Piracy Acts. But now they're on the offensive trying to ensure they never get passed.
I think they're just trying to find some practical middle ground, really. You know, the problem with this whole restrictive thing is that, you know, when we saw those lawsuits being filed by the RIAA and so on to stop music piracy and so on, and they kept pushing, and they kept pushing, and, you know, they'd file these insane lawsuits, and I mean, the problem is that they go overboard. You know, and they go overboard until somebody has to push back, and then you try to find some common ground where you can make it work. And to me, that's what the debate is all about.
Let's say in a digital police state world that these acts were passed. How would this even affect the average web surfer if these acts were passed?
Well, you know, in a variety of ways. It just depends on who you are and what you're doing. You know, we were talking before the show. There are various times where people will even use illegal content without even knowing.
Right.
You know, they'll just go to Jim's website and be downloading a movie. They're not really paying attention to the fact that that may or may not be licensable to them. It's just – so if that site goes down because somebody's had to shut it down, then you're going to lose.
Isn't this what we saw more than a decade ago with Napster and what we're seeing with BitTorrent and networks like that exist now? In spite of and because of content providers?
It shows us this many years into the internet, we still haven't figured out how to play nice with each other online.
So what's the real problem? I mean, tell us about what's happening with BitTorrent over in Sweden, George.
Oh, that is hilarious. When I saw this, I thought I was reading like an April Fool's joke. There are people in Sweden that have actually convinced the government to recognize file sharing as an official religion, saying that they consider the Control-Alt to be a religious symbol. And they failed in their first couple of attempts to do this, but on their third attempt, they actually, you know, of course, I guess they're very tolerant in Europe, you know, and they'll allow anything that's semi-reasonable to take place, but they actually got recognition. And, I mean, it's obvious that the more official sanction that they get, the safer they are in terms of operating, you know, a file-sharing entity.
And I guess by that rationale of secular humanism, Control-Alt-Delete is the Armageddon version of that control.
Yeah, it's sort of like the religions that smoke marijuana, you know, and consider it to be a religious rite, you know. So,
but it also sort of points up, though, an ethic that's evolved over the last couple decades about, I ought to get my stuff for free. And people just sort of assuming because it's technically possible, yeah, that ought to be legally possible as well. And we haven't figured that out yet.
I was going to say, it has almost, Thomas O'Brien, become a religious or cult experience, as Scott pointed out, to say that we are democratized now. We demand this for free. It frees my soul to go to Wikipedia. It frees my soul to not be hemmed up by some copyright issues or proprietary stuff, to be able to exercise my individual freedom to go get this stuff, even if it's off of BitTorrent. What do you think about that, Tom?
Well, I mean, there's David Pogue wrote a piece about this, too. There's that other contingent that figures into this, which is the libertarians who are saying, look, it all ought to be free. This whole concept of privatizing this sort of thing doesn't have legs. So, you know, that's pretty extreme.
What's interesting to me about the SOPA Act and Google blacking out its banner, it sort of speaks up to the power of some of these online companies now. So imagine if Google uses its Google Doodle, the way it plays around with this logo, to weigh in on whether we ought to go to war with Iran or about a tax policy. They're pretty strong, loud voice.
Well, Ian and KC thinks that piracy would be reduced if companies charge less for their products. What do you think about that, George?
I'm all for it. I mean, when you're talking about charging less for their products, are we talking about content like movies, or are we talking about services like cable access?
I think he's talking about across the board piracy as a concept. If companies as a concept, companies being the esoteric big guys around the world.
It goes without saying that, I mean, that the cheaper the price is, the easier people can handle it. I mean, just look at the App Store, you know, where you can buy an app for 99 cents. I mean, whether it's free or 99 cents doesn't make a whole lot of difference because most people can afford $1 or $2. But if it's $20 or $200, that's a different animal.
But isn't it going to be, in the end, the dilution of pricing, the iTunes concept for 99 cents, the app concept for, you know, pennies on the dollar, that's actually going to dilute what these companies are talking about and not the free downloads?
Well, it's kind of the middleman thing. I mean, I think if you're the artist, the provider, originator of the content, you're not probably being paid what you should be paid for your work. Who's getting the money? You're getting a trickle, but the torrent is going to these media companies who are the middle people, and those are the ones that this, you know, a large contingent of people think are not playing fair.
But to that end, some people have been getting a nickel on a dollar from an album since the days of 8-tracks. So
true, true. But you know, the other
as long
side
as they
of,
can hold the copyright,
right,
sure.
Right. Look at what's happened on the App Store. Just the App Store, just in the last couple of years, Apple just reported the other day that since the inception of the App Store, that they, you know, their deal is, just so that everybody understands, if a developer puts an app up on the App Store, it's essentially a 2/3, 1/3 kind of a split. You know, the developer gets 2/3 and Apple takes 1/3. Apple has paid out in the last couple of years $4 billion to developers. Now, hey, that's an industry, $4 billion.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that's at 99 cents a throw or, you know, $2 a throw. I mean, that's big money. That's probably the biggest software market in existence right now.
That's big money, but it's not nearly as big as it should be when you consider that Apple has $100 billion in the bank in cash. So, you know, one could argue that $4 billion is a pittance and that the developers ought to be getting a lot more.
What does Apple's
cash
hoard have to do with any of this?
Pardon me?
What does Apple's cash hoard have to do with
any of this? Well, we know that they're making a whole lot of money. And on a unit basis, that's, you know, you can, if you break it down on a unit basis, they're a very profitable business. They've got pricing power, which means that they can basically, they can price their product any way they want to and people are going to buy it. They're so popular. This is all good. I'm all happy with that. But what I'm contrasting that with is the fact that they're really just doling out this little pittance to the developers who are having to support their own business on a small slice of the money because Apple controls the marketplace.
Well, but the other side of that is that there are plenty of small developers who could never get their product into the marketplace because they don't have the money to produce or package or distribute or whatever, and here they've got a marketplace, and they're making money they couldn't make otherwise.
And that's what this discussion is really all about. Scott Cannon, bringing you back in, what can the government do from a policy perspective to streamline a lot of this internet, or should the government leave the internet alone?
Well, I'm not an opinion journalist, so I'm not going to.
Based on your reportage.
Oh, come on,
Scott. I'm not going to tell you what the government
forecast. News analysis. Right. Do a news analysis for us.
Right.
What do you think?
What the government could do to do what?
Okay. What extent should the government be involved in internet traffic, internet access, internet taxation, any of that?
Well, I can tell you the government is – the Obama administration, for instance, is very involved in trying to increase broadband availability. And we can debate about whether that's something the government ought to be doing because it quickly ends up being city folk subsidizing the connections of urban folk. But, you know, there's a lot it can do. It's a political decision which way you want to go.
Nolan emails us at centralstandard@kcur.org to say Louis C.K. is a great example of how companies can handle the Internet's open information philosophy. Not only did he sell over $1 million worth of his stand-up, he made tons more than he would have made had he gone through a label or network. That's a perfect example of using the Internet's power to go directly to your audience.
You know, and Google Music is doing something similar to that where your garage band can put stuff up there and they'll sell you a cut's not dissimilar to what the Apple iTunes store, I think, is. So there's clearly new ways for small outfits to make it big just because they can reach an audience they couldn't before.
And what did Louis C.K. actually do?
What did he do? He did a comedy show, and he put the show up for free download.
Boom.
Yeah, that's what he did.
And that's how he led more people to his product.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with that?
That's perfect. That's a great example.
I think as long as it was his decision to do that, I mean, why not?
We're going to click pause on this interface right now and take a quick break. When we return, more with George Costello, independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien, CEO of Ideology. We'd also like to bring Scott Cannon in for the second half of the show from the Kansas City Star. Thanks for sitting in and joining us again. Kansas City, what is your biggest concern about the future of the Internet? We're talking high-tech policy today, and we want you to join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Also, feel free to use the latest gadgets, such as Facebook and Twitter. At KCURCST is our handle there. See you when we get back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. A little more than a decade ago, my coverage of the Advisory Commission on Internet Taxation and E-commerce took me to Virginia, California, New York, Texas. And by the end of these big meetings, this group of government officials, executives, plus conservative gadfly Grover Norquist, who is in a category all by himself, none of them had decided whether or not there should be a tax on Internet access, usage, or commerce. So technology obviously moves faster than policy, and tech policy is our discussion on today's program and in this second half. Yet tech policy is what we're discussing, and part of our tech lightning round will involve some tech policy items as well. Here to help boot up this continued conversation is George Costello. He comes back. Thomas O'Brien, the CEO of Ideology, and Scott Cannon from the Kansas City Star. Meanwhile, Kansas City, what is your biggest concern about the Internet that is within your power to vote for or against as a user and citizen? Would you pay a tax to use the web, either for access or to shop online? 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Also, Facebook and Twitter are options, too. At Twitter, it's at KCURCST. I normally don't ask anybody to do this, but would you pay a tax? Are you for or against a tax for the Internet?
Well, I'm not necessarily for taxes in general. However, I mean, this is just a rerun of what's come before. I mean, look at what the government did with phone service. Remember when, you know, all we had was just plain old telephone service? If you had a standard phone line with AT&T, I remember looking at my phone bill and the charge for the actual phone service was maybe $12 or $13, and then there was another $15 worth of fees and FCC charges and state charges and government charges and Kansas City charges.
And a telecommunications excise tax.
I mean, it got so insane that the charges were more than what the service was. But, I mean, that's what the government does. They put excise taxes on phone service, remember, after World War II, and then they stayed there forever. So I think it's inevitable that we're going to see taxes of some kind.
How do you feel about that, Thomas O'Brien? And if there had to be a tax, would you prefer an access tax or an actual sales tax tied to e-commerce?
I think most of us wouldn't even know if there were a tax. You know, I mean, it'd just be lumped in with our cable or or whatever our access bill was, and most people aren't going to pay the attention to that little tiny amount. What they do pay attention to is when they go online and buy something, and then they have to pay state sales tax. And that's where the current activity is. There's two bills in Congress that are proposing a way to smooth that out and sort of level that playing field, where, you know, now you can buy from some online sellers and you're not going to pay any sales tax, but you could buy the same thing from Amazon and you would end up paying right. sales tax because Amazon has a point of presence in your state. So it is a little bit uneven. Both, oddly enough, or I think interestingly, these two bills exempt companies with sales of less than online sales of less than $1 million, and in one case less than $500,000. So there'd still be some people who would be exempt as online sellers from sales tax on a state basis.
And Scott, when they convened this dubious panel about 12 years ago, Governor Jim Gilmore, the then governor of Virginia, was the chairman of it, and Barksdale from Netscape was on it, Richard Parsons from Time Warner at the time, Citigroup later, was on it. And it was just a cottage cheese of convolution about sales tax jurisdictions, state tax, federal tax, what jurisdiction the seller was in, what jurisdiction right. the server was in.
Right.
How do you even simplify this thing if it's feasible?
Well, we haven't figured that out yet, I guess. I mean, part of what's going on, though, is you know, I think Amazon has decided whether to have a presence in a state or not a state, California particularly. I forget how it's all sorted out. Because if you don't have a facility in California, but that's a big market to you, well, there's a place where you can sell a lot of stuff and people don't have to pay a sales tax. So they've played, you know, that issue trying to be different places to either have that advantage over the brick-and-mortar store down the street from you or be somewhere else.
And what they were saying back then is the sky is not falling. E-commerce only accounts for a small percentage of regular commerce. But then you look at what happened this past year mm-hmm. with the largest Cyber Monday ever, and then you start to look at that like, there could be some tax revenue there. So how has it changed, Tom?
You know, right now, I have a business, and I sell stuff in Missouri. When I pay my sales tax in Missouri, I have to go through a 30-page document and break down where I've sold right. everything by taxing jurisdiction.
Wow.
So that gets a little onerous on a small business, and that's, you know, a huge point that the online resellers are making is the fact that they have to get so granular. There are 7,500 taxing mm-hmm. districts in the United States. If you sell across the country and you have to collect sales tax and remit it back to each one of those with all their different rules and all their different paper, it's going to get just bizarre.
Well, and there's a bunch of them right here in the metro. You know, every little metro area sometimes has its own little unique taxation rules.
Or there's an overlay district, like a performing arts district yeah. that has a different tax than right. the, you know, downtown right next door to it.
Scott, given your knowledge of business and policy from having reported on it, is the internet a good case for examining the possibility of a uniform or flat tax?
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be that easy to get there because, as he describes, all these businesses or all these taxing districts would make an argument that they're imposing these taxes not just to annoy you, but because they need the funds. And if his product is being delivered by a UPS guy to your house, okay, there's a little wear and tear on the streets there. That UPS driver might run a stoplight, and the cops need to deal with that. There's an expense to making the world run. And you know, the libertarian ethics suggests that for some reason, particularly on the internet, that things should be exempt from that, but it doesn't really translate to a real world.
We're talking tech policy here on Central Standard. Internet tax, net neutrality, privacy, all of the things that the government could, should, or would be involved in. What's your opinion on it? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And you can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is also an option. Our Twitter handle is @KCURCST. Tom, we hear about compliance software all the time. Would there be a technological way to measure whether tax collection could even be enforced on the internet? in the first place? Would there be a way to measure it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I got to go back to my office and fix that one up real quick so that I can make some money on it. You know, it's complex, and there's no question about that. And the point, I think, really, though, is it is a matter of a business advantage, I mean, and fairness for resellers. Now, you got to put this in context. Something like 87% of internet sales are done by these huge tech giants like Amazon. The piece of the pie for the small business sector is very tiny. So, you know, maybe they have an advantage because they're exempted from these sales tax acts that are being proposed in Congress, and more of an onus is put on the big ones like Amazon. We'll see how that all shakes out.
You know, part of the problem with government is, particularly you get into tough times, you know, when the revenue dries up and they start looking around. I mean, they just get creative and inventive. I mean, look at the Kansas City Water Department came up with this tax where if you have a large area that's paved or cement, you have more runoff, you know, so therefore you're putting more water in the sewers. And so they charge you an extra tax for that. Over in Mission, there's this big debate going on about the driveway tax, you know, how many cars, you know, you put on. They just come up with all these creative ways. They invent ways to create taxes. Well, I mean, that's the history. I mean, as I just mentioned with the telephone bill thing, they just killed, to me, the telephone business. I mean, I gave up my landline completely.
That's not what's killed landline business.
Well, that's part of it, though. I mean,
no, it's not at all. It's the cell phone is more convenient, and why do I want both?
And
in fact, with your cell phone, you're paying those similar taxes. I can get – if I'm a low-income individual, if I meet certain requirements – I now can get a free cell phone with a free number of minutes per month.
That's true.
The same way people would get a subsidized landline before. So people are not shifting from landline to some other device because of the taxes, other than the sense that it's part of – it's cumulative and now that bill is – you know, it reached some critical mass that they want to dump it. But, I mean, we've had the taxes on telephone service haven't – increased dramatically in recent years. It's been a technological shift.
Landlines are redundant, so we drop them. Why pay for it?
Right.
What then becomes redundant in the world of internet access?
Bingo. There's the question right there. It's going to be interesting to find out. It's going to take a long, long time to shake out. No question about it.
So what's obviously the unifying factor of all this? Does it come down to privacy? When you look at intellectual property, when you look at taxation, when you look at net neutrality, when you look at personal preferences, does it all come down to privacy as far as what the government can do policy-wise? Is privacy the one area where we can all agree the government may need to step in on internet policy?
I did a search last night on privacy laws, and the list that came back just since 1990 was staggeringly long. There are privacy laws that affect all sorts of different human activities or inactivities, and it's a little scary. And then besides having to sort out a given privacy situation, you have the Patriot Act, which opens up the window for law enforcement to get underneath those privacy laws. You know, I think we're all familiar with, or a lot of us are familiar with, you get a statement from your credit card company every year. They got to send you a privacy statement now. That didn't happen 15 years ago. They didn't have to acknowledge it. So in some ways, that's all good because, you know, if you pay attention. The problem is I think a lot of people aren't paying attention. There's been a big dust-up just in the last day about Google because Google has revised its privacy policy or proposed that it's going to revise its privacy policy beginning March 1st. Instead of having a separate policy for all their different activities, all the different websites they operate, they're going to unify it. And, you know, people are concerned that now they're going to be able to track much more of their own activities online.
And we're going to tackle that, and we're going to talk a lot faster when we tackle that in the next couple of minutes here. Privacy, intellectual property, taxation, net neutrality, all part of a comprehensive tech policy that we've been discussing, all part of the vital signs of what the internet will look like in the future. We've been discussing these items with George Costello, an independent Mac and Apple consultant, Thomas O'Brien, and he's the CEO of Ideology, and Scott Cannon, who's a reporter with the Kansas City Star. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and now...
It's time now for a technology news lightning round with Thomas O'Brien and George Costello.
All right, we're about to make it rain. iPads and iPods recession-proof, selling like hotcakes. Apple's Q1 results stellar. Is it business as usual, or is this a game changer in tech?
Oh, it's a game changer. No question about it. Apple sold more iPads than HP sold computers. And Tim Cook was right the other day on the phone call that he did with analysts when he said that it's just a matter of time before iPads, or the concept of tablets anyway, becomes the dominant player.
A killer statistic about the Q1 results, the quarter one results for Apple, more profit in this one quarter than revenue for the entire hold of 2010.
More revenue than all the grosses from all the movies in Hollywood combined.
That's ridiculous.
They're worth more than the country of Greece.
They're worth more than the country of Greece. They have more cash than the U.S. government on hand.
Yeah. And it's all being driven by one thing, the iPhone.
And, by the way, two-thirds of that money is offshore, and they can't bring it back because of taxation policy.
Speaking of offshore, Nintendo, on the other hand, big in the loss column, big losses, sales down 32%, Wii sales are off. Where are all the gamers migrating?
Don't know.
Xbox? Yeah, I guess. I don't know. You know, it's in the gaming thing, it seems to be one of those whack-a-mole sort of deals. Somebody will come up with something new. You know, Microsoft and the Xbox has really been propelled a lot by Kinect because it's a controllerless environment. You know, you just stand in front of it. You know, years ago, Nintendo was leading because they had better games. So, you know, innovation in the gaming area is great, and it's huge, and it's just a matter of time before somebody else innovates their way to the top.
Thomas was talking about Google's new privacy policy, but I'm going to flip it over to George on that. Google's new privacy policy, pass or fail? What do you think?
I think the jury's out. I mean, I personally don't like it. I mean, I don't like any of those kind of intrusions where – you know, they can stick their nose and know everything that there is to know about you.
It's interesting on the policy issue. There's sort of two lanes here. One is the Patriot Act sort of thing. What's the government looking at your stuff? And the other is, what is business doing with it? Are they data mining on you? Are they tracking your habits? And although people sort of most people pay lip service to wanting to protect their privacy, time and time again, they're willing to give it up if it makes their Google products or anything else a little bit better because it's just easier to use what they're offering you.
More to add on privacy. Google also recently announced that it was going to customize its search capability to make search results more tailored to a user's specific search patterns, which begs the question, how do you know about what I'm doing on the search with the search?
Well, you know.
They're watching you. They're watching you, Jabalani.
Yeah, and the other thing is that, you know, people are so fixated on Google, they tend to forget that there's 8 or 9 other good search engines out there. I mean, you don't have to use Google. You could use Ask, A-S-K, which will allow you to erase your browsing history if you want.
The artist formerly known as Ask Jeeves.
Yeah, there's Bing and there's a whole bunch of others. I mean, you don't have to use Google.
Well, and you can use Google in a way that sort of anonymizes your behavior if you want to as well.
Right,
people
just
would rather cash in on the dividends that comes with them knowing more about what you want.
On the Nintendo item and where gamers might be moving, we have Will, who called in from Kearney, saying essentially gamers are moving to free games such as the ones on social media. Thank you for Will for that contribution to the Tech Lightning Round. Given what you said about Google and given the existence of other search engines, is there a danger if Google gets a little too fancy and a little bit too big and violates the credo of its do no evil that there could lose some market share in search and what happened to Microsoft with the out-of-box software or what happened to, you know, Oracle, for instance?
This whole process is always a seesaw kind of a situation. They're going to overreach and overreach and overreach until somebody starts pushing back or abandons them, you know, and it's going to seesaw back and forth.
Speaking of pushing back, nothing to Motorola suing Apple?
Of course there is. Motorola's owned by, what, Google now?
Yeah.
And And I mean, they're in court all around the world. You know, I mean, Apple's fighting Android, and Google's not happy about it, and so they just go at each other. It's become a game. It's like watching football.
Here's something that's very interesting, Thomas. Symantec this week took the highly unusual step of telling users of its PC Anywhere remote access software to disable it because it's telling its customers that there was a security breach by our favorite hacktivist group, Anonymous. What kind of security world are we living in when Symantec, the top antivirus software company that owned that software product, it says, yo, disable this.
Yeah.
It sucks.
PC Anywhere is kind of a real niche player. It's not a security product on its own, so it probably doesn't have much effect in the pond, although I think it's they've learned now to get out in front of these things and announce quickly and then repair the damage much more quickly and get it past them.
George, Tom, as you predicted, the Thailand floods have led to a hardware drive shortage.
Boy.
NVIDIA, Intel, and Advanced Micro Devices were all affected. What now? They announced that their first quarter numbers would be off because of what happened at the end of last year. Now we're moving into January 29th announcements based on what happened and the continued glut. What's going on in the hardware drive market?
Well, I mean, there's flooding in Thailand, and the supply has dried up. I mean, it's not going to come back. I mean, it takes a long time to build a factory, you know, so we're stuck.
Yeah, they're thinking September before they get back to normal production. Where it really hurts is in your pocketbook because you're paying $50 to $100 more for a PC than you were. Companies like Apple, it really hasn't shown up yet because they have such a deep supply chain and such
and
power.
High gross profit margins.
Yeah. But on the PC side, it's people that are buying servers or that are buying just machines for home, they're paying more money.
Let's give Scott Cannon a little lightning in this lightning round. Scott, you argued that perhaps Google Broadband and Google Fiber would create a more eco-friendly, energy-efficient society. You argued that in a recent article. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it could, because it could allow, for instance, the obvious thing is telecommuting. So instead of driving 10 miles to work and 10 miles back, maybe you're staying at home and doing things over the computer, because now you can have a video feed that's high definition without any herky-jerky delay, and you can work in a fully optional way. When you look at that a little closer, it gets complicated. So the energy savings are cut back a little bit when you consider, well, the office is still open, so maybe they've still got the lights on there. Now you're running the furnace at home. The research tends to suggest you're probably still saving some energy, but a lot of these questions get pretty complicated.
And speaking of access, newer, faster Wi-Fi standards coming in 2012, perhaps, Thomas.
Mm-mm.
No?
Mm-mm.
No, not coming?
At some point, it's going to happen. You know, the standards bodies are behind the technology at this point. And what good is it going to be for us to have Google Fiber if our wireless devices can't go really fast, right? So, you know, we go out now and we buy a wireless in router so right. that we've got much faster hundreds of megabits in our house or in our office. The next one coming down the line could be called 802.11ac,
right.
which is going to just use more bandwidth to give you a faster wireless experience. I think the reason that people just keep it in the back of your mind, because we don't buy routers very often. We might buy one every 5 years or every 3 years in our house. Next time you go out, if it's later this year or next holiday season, keep an eye out for AC.
I would like to point out that the battle over finalizing the 11N standard took
802.11N standard.
11N took over 3 years. The body that approves those things meets in some place like Geneva or Brussels or someplace like that. And if even one person, one rep from one country has an objection about something, then they'll table it until the next meeting. Well, there were draft 11N spec routers out there for a couple of years almost, you know, until they finally finalized. It took 3 years to get agreement on that standard. So I don't expect them to just, approve it this fall and it's going to be available in the stores anytime soon.
Proof positive once again that tech policy is way slower than technology itself. On Twitter, MMOUF starts up that gaming conversation again and disagrees with our caller from before that gamers were moving to free small app games and casuals are just playing them, is what MMOUF says. Gamers set sales records last year with Call of Duty. So now we have a mm-hmm. sort of subgenre of arguing on our technology. Well,
we were talking about that last time. Call of Duty sold $400 million in its first day. You know, the paid game is big, and it's here to stay.
And the copyright issue is also part and parcel to that game issue as well.
Sure.
The Generation Nano recall update. What's happening with that?
Hey, this is really cool. You know, I for some reason ended up with three Nanos that were first generation Nanos, so I sent them all into Apple, and they've been sending me back.
You sent them in because?
Well, the issue was that there was a potential fire hazard with the battery.
The old lithium ion battery thing.
As the battery aged, it had more of a propensity to get too
overheat,
hot.
Overheat, right.
So Apple got out in front of this. But what they're doing is not repairing them. They're just replacing them with new Nanos, and that's pretty cool.
So you send in your new Nanos. You mention it on the radio. You get new Nanos. Right. That's a trifecta for you right there.
Absolutely.
Waterproof phones and tablets on the way. What's going on with
that? It's about time, don't you think? How many times have you dropped one drop of water on your cell phone?
And how many times have you been chilling in the pool and said, you know what,
right.
I could use the iPad.
Right.
Turns that little
with this floating
dot
rubber
yellow.
Ducky. Yeah. Certainly.
There's a nanotechnology. It's a spray coating. It dries, and it's kind of a little water repellent thing that
really?
Is hopefully going to be put on every electronic portable device we carry so that we can not worry too much about that water drop.
Because everybody wants to web surf underwater.
Isn't that the guy I'm
or
seeing?
Or in the rain, right?
Yeah. Isn't that the guy on the TV infomercials that's spraying the black rubber coating at $19.95 a can?
So you can just get a big baggie and jump in.
And that's a good time for the tech lightning round to end right there. George Costello, independent Mac consultant, Thomas O'Brien, CEO of Ideology. And we'd like to thank Scott Cannon from the Kansas City Star for joining us on this Tech Policy, Tech Lightning Round, All Things Technology Central Standard Edition. Gentlemen, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Great to
and
be
tune in tomorrow for the Walt Bodine Show with co-host Monroe Dodd. He'll be hosting a history show with a familiar KCUR voice as his guest, Miss Gina Kaufman, who has recently released a new book looking at notable KC women in history. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi, executive produced by Bill Anderson. We have help today and this week from Tamika Weatherspoon. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Mutert manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney, and what you're hearing right now, the outro, by The Will Knots. Up to Date is next with a look at parents, teens, and ADHD. What are the Up to Date talking about again? Okay. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and this is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.